Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, March 18, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on national security, the United Nations, and the extraterritorial application of treaties. My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today we're pleased to welcome three experts. Our first is Professor Peter Margulies from Roger Williams University School of Law. Our next expert is Dr. Nicholas Rostow, Director of the Center for Strategic Research at National Defense University and Senior Research Scholar in Law at Yale Law School. And finally, our third expert is Mr. Edwin Williamson, who is of counsel at Sullivan & Cromwell. More complete bios of our speakers were provided to you in notice of the call, so I will stop there and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. The way it's going to work today is each of our speakers is going to take about 10 minutes to give their take on the topic, followed by possibly some discussion between them, and then, of course, your questions for the second half of the call. So I'll stop there and turn it over to Mr. Williamson, who's going to speak first, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Christian. This is Edwin Williamson. One addition on my bio that I would add, just to put it a little in context, I was served as a State Department legal advisor under the first President Bush, so I'm a predecessor of Harold Coes. So basically, we're going to discuss these two memoranda that mysteriously appeared in the New York Times the other day, written by the then legal advisor Harold Coe, basically both proposing the expanded geographical scope of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, or the ICCPR, and the expanded geographical scope of the Convention Against Torture. Or CAT, which we'll call it sometimes. I'm assuming that most listeners are familiar with the contents of the memos and the issues, but let me just quickly summarize what I see them as. The ICCPR provides that, quote, each state party to the present covenant undertakes to respect and to ensure to all individuals within its territory and subject to its jurisdiction, the rights recognized in the present covenant without distinction of any kind, such as race, color, etc. So the question is, how should this language be read? Should it be read as each state party undertakes to respect and to ensure, comma, to all individuals within its territory and subject to its jurisdiction, comma, the rights recognized in the covenant? That doesn't work too well, but it requires one to make sense of, quote, respect, quote, all individuals, etc. But anyway, this is essentially the reading adopted by the United States government. Second, another reading is each state party undertakes to respect, comma, and to ensure to all individuals within its territory and subject to its jurisdiction, comma, the rights recognized in the present covenant. That is, so ensure has a geographical limitation, whereas respect is universal. The third reading is each state undertakes to respect and to ensure to all individuals within its territory or subject to its jurisdiction the rights recognized in the present covenant. This seems to be the most problematic reading just from a straight parsing standpoint, because it requires one to make sense of the respect all individuals and so forth, but it also basically changes the word and to or. In other words, it gives and a disjunctive meaning. I'm going to refer to this as the basic extraterritorial interpretation. Surprisingly, one might say after this analysis, it is in fact that it's the third reading that is prevalent among the international community, and which is critical of the United States for not adopting it. I think Harold would be happy with the U.S. government's acceptance of that reading. He actually seems to be proposing the second reading, that is, do not read respect and ensure together. And while I indicated in my summary of that reading that there's no extraterritorial effect, no extraterritorial limitation on respect, Harold does appear to accept some geographical limitation on the respect obligation. Well, anyway, this back to my first question is, what are we to make of this mysterious appearance of these memos, and what should we do about them? My first reaction brings to mind an article that appeared in the midst of the treaty interpretation squabble that arose from my predecessor, Abe Sofia's reading of the ABM treaty back in the 1980s. The article was entitled "The President versus the Senate in Treaty Interpretation: What's All the Fuss About?" And it was written by a young Yale professor named Harold Coe. In it, Coe said that if a president's understanding of a treaty does not match the Senate's, he lacks the freedom to interpret it inconsistently with the Senate's understanding. Now, there are a lot of questions lurking in that, such as how do you determine what those understandings are and so forth. But it seems to me that what Harold is proposing is that the Obama administration interpret the ICCPR in a way that no one has seriously proposed before, and that certainly in a way that certainly is not what the Congress or the Obama and previous administrations have understood what the ICCPR means. The other part of my what's the fuss all about is that it seems that the proponents of the extraterritorial approach are probably thinking of applying the ICCPR to conflict situations, where I would say, I think Harold accepts this, the law of war or the law of armed conflict or international humanitarian law, whatever you'd like to call it, let's just call it IHL, applies as lex specialis, and where human rights law does not apply. There the debate is probably over whether there is a conflict subject to IHL, but we can save that to another day. My last point on the ICCPR memo is that this was dated October 9, 2010, and it obviously did not get anywhere within the Obama administration, since the Obama administration took the same essential position as previous administrations in its 2011 presentation to the Human Rights Committee, and of course, as it did last week. On the CAT memo, again, basically the argument is over its extraterritorial application, but in a slightly different context. There are essentially three issues: whether the term, quote, territory under its jurisdiction means territory under a state party's governmental or de jure control, or territory under its effective control. Second, whether Article 3, prohibiting the expulsion, extradition, or refoulement, or return, of a person to a state where he would be in danger of torture, applies to a person in the state party's custody, but outside the territory under its jurisdiction. Article 3, unlike most other provisions in the CAT, doesn't have any language one way or the other in respect of the territory that's covered. And then third, whether the CAT applies in situations of armed conflict. These are very complex issues, and we really don't have time to get into them, so I'm not going to get into the substance of these issues, but I will just make a couple of passing comments, and mainly having to do with the second of those points, and that is the interpretation of Article 3. The position that the U.S. takes is that it only applies in respect of a person who is in the state U.S. custody in its territory. follows very closely the Supreme Court decision in a case called Salle versus Haitian Sinners Council, which arose under the Refugee Convention. The Article 33 of the Refugee Convention uses essentially the same language, although clearly the two treaties set out to do different things. But the position of the U.S. has basically been that the Supreme Court interpreted those words, and that's what it's following. Anyway, as I said, we don't really have time to get into that much of the substance of it, so I'll just note in closing that, consistent with my question of what are we to make of the leak of these two memos, that it strikes me as a pretty naughty thing to drop this memorandum on the, written on the legal advisor's letterhead on the table as one walks out the door, and basically for three reasons. First, it seems clear that this has not been reviewed within the normal interagency channels that a definitive pronouncement by the legal advisor would normally be subject to. In fact, the Obama administration seems to have rejected the suggestions in these memos. Second, I understand that it did not even go through the normal channel within the legal advisor's office that something like this would normally go through. And then third, I think it shows an incredible lack of respect for what has been done by previous administrations, including being wrong on things such as the U.S. position being newfound, unavailable, et cetera. Now, there's nothing wrong with rejecting positions of prior administrations, but in this case, the positions are not the positions of some political types, but they represent the positions of the career lawyers and the legal advisor's office as well. I think that puts it in a different light. So on that, I'll pass it on to Peter.
Thanks, Edwin. I guess I'd push back a little bit in the following ways. First, I'd say that, as Edwin indicated, this is really a dispute about the word and what it means. And to that extent, it's really a study in why people hate lawyers, because and is kind of a small word, but actually it does mean a lot here, as lawyers know and as Edwin indicated. This dispute also has to be informed, I'd submit, by the views of the framers. Of course, that's characteristic of the Federalist Society, one of the best things about the Society's inquiries over the years. And then it also has to be informed by the best way for the U.S. to build on the leadership role in the global community that the U.S. voluntarily assumed in the wake of World War II. What do I mean by this? Well, first, the framers. They considered U.S. compliance with international law to be a top priority. Alexander Hamilton, for example, called it a test of national character. In fact, the U.S. failure in pre-constitutional days to comply with international law undermined our reputation globally and our foreign relations and was a primary factor in driving the Constitution's enactment. Well, let's look at that in the context of the text of the ICCPR. As Edwin recognized, that text is ambiguous. So, for example, you could interpret it the way the U.S. does and say, well, you must respect and to ensure to all individuals within territory and subject to jurisdiction the rights that the treaty guarantees. But if you read that closely, that reading, the U.S. reading, enables some pretty bad grammar. We'd never say, I'm going to respect those rights to you. We'd say, I respect rights owed to you, belonging to you, accruing to you. So the U.S. really adds words in its interpretation. In that sense, it's not that different from the interpretation of the rest of the world, which also adds words, which basically says this should be interpreted disjunctively as reading, we guarantee these rights to all individuals within a state's territory and to individuals who are subject to that state's jurisdiction. They both add words. The U.S. Foreign Relations Committee actually saw things the rest of the way the world does. So in its report on the treaty in 1992, it said that the covenant guarantees rights to all individuals within a state's territory and to individuals subject to its jurisdiction. The Senate added a whole plenitude of reservations, understandings, and declarations to the treaty that singled out some matters like the juvenile death penalty, other things that are important to U.S. jurisprudence at the time. It didn't add anything that displaced the reading of the rest of the world on extraterritoriality. One reason for that, I submit, is rooted in the object and purpose of the ICCPR. And that's very important under the Vienna Convention for interpreting treaties. And here you want to look to whether a treaty passes what I'll call the Auschwitz test. If a treaty only applies within a state's territory, then Auschwitz isn't covered, because after all, Auschwitz was in Poland, not on German territory. For a treaty that was drafted in the wake of World War II, it makes no sense to say the drafters want to permit an Auschwitz exception. So that's another compelling reason for the interpretation favored by the rest of the world and not the U.S. interpretation. Let's look also at Eleanor Roosevelt. Eleanor Roosevelt is important here because she was the primary drafter of the ICCPR as the chief delegate to the United Nations after World War II. Eleanor objected to a language that was earlier put in the treaty, but on much more limited grounds than the one that the U.S. now propounds. So Eleanor Roosevelt objected to language that said that a state had to guarantee rights outside of its own territory. She rightly said that we couldn't guarantee, we're in no position to guarantee that former Axis powers like Germany and Japan that we occupied after World War II would respect people's rights. But we could undertake to respect those rights by our own actions when we controlled territory. If you look at whether that interpretation favors U.S. policy and serves U.S. interests, the answer is it does so just fine. So take the question of NSA surveillance abroad, which has been much in the news lately. Article 17 of the ICCPR bars arbitrary intrusions on privacy. European courts, interpreting the European Convention, which in many ways tracks the ICCPR, European courts have been pragmatic and largely defer to states on foreign surveillance. They said that targeted monitoring of communications using keywords, exactly what the NSA is doing, promotes national security. So they said that's an appropriate non-arbitrary purpose of surveillance. And when plaintiffs have sought disclosure of precise criteria used in surveillance, EU courts have said that would let terrorists game the system. So it's out of bounds. In many ways, in fact, the U.S. currently has tighter controls on foreign surveillance in European countries, for example, more judicial involvement. You could say that more reforms would be appropriate. We can argue about that. But in sum, I'd say, looking at the ICCPR, Hamilton was right. Compliance with international law is a test of national character. And agreeing to extraterritorial application of the ICCPR confirms our leadership on international law and also serves U.S. interests. Thanks. I'll swing it over to Nick.
Thanks, Peter, and thanks, Edwin, and I commend you for your very serious and comprehensive comments. Let me begin by an obligatory disclaimer. I am speaking in my personal capacity and not on behalf of the U.S. government or the Department of Defense or the National Defense University. And like Edwin, I should add a little bit to my bio just so that the audience understands why I'm here. I served with Edwin in the first Bush administration. I was legal advisor to the National Security Council. And then I served in the second Bush the Younger administration when I was chief lawyer at the U.S. mission to the UN. And I raise this last point because I think that like any committee product, this language of the convention needs to be understood as a political adjustment among competing views, I'm sure, and that leaves room for the United States to, like every other party, to interpret and apply the language in a not irrational way and not a way that is not disconnected from the words or the intention of the treaty, but in a way that is realistic and practical. And while I appreciate the Auschwitz exception mentioned by Peter, I don't think that prevention of Auschwitz was the actual intention of this treaty, and it wouldn't have done it. And there were plenty of ways to hold the Germans accountable for Auschwitz and every other crime they committed without it. The second point I would make is that one, the United States comes to extraterritoriality with unclean hands, if you will. We are, above all other countries, famous for the extraterritorial application of our statutes and jurisdiction, whether it's the Alien Tort Claims Act or the antitrust laws. We don't regard the territory of the United States as necessarily limiting the reach of our judicial system. And the third point I would make is that as a government of lawyers, not of men, we put most actions to legal tests in a very rigorous way. And I agree with Edwin completely in his analysis of how come these memoranda have appeared at this particular moment, and with the problems that they reveal. I'd like to say a few words about the recent NSA disclosures and kerfuffle. The first point I'd like to make is that as far as international law goes, intelligence collection is something that is not explicitly recognized, but everybody does it, and so every country does it at its own risk. Second thing is that every intelligence service in the world is saying there, but for the grace of God, go I. And with respect to every intelligence service, I mean every intelligence service, whether it's Russian or Chinese or Cuban or German or French. When I was doing my PhD research, I did a PhD in history before going to law school, I came across a transcript in the beautiful French language of a telephone call between Franklin D. Roosevelt and William Bullitt, his ambassador in Paris in the 1930s, beautifully translated into French. The voice of Franklin Roosevelt was unmistakable, but it was clear that the French had been tapping the ambassador's telephone. Was that legal? Was it lawful? Was it an undue interference in the communications between the head of state and his chief diplomat? Of course. So what? So one needs to take all of this with a grain of salt. We live in a certain technological context, and the law and operations have to be understood in that context. I hasten to say that I have not studied the ICCPR in the detail that Edwin and Peter have done, but I do side on the come down in favor of a textual analysis that is fair to the text, and in my experience, and has a tendency to mean and, not or, and that when one needs to rewrite a text in order to achieve a certain political purpose, that is dangerous and slippery ground. And why don't I stop there and let the audience have as much time as they would like.
This is Christian Corrigan. So thank you to all three of our speakers for those excellent opening statements. And we will go ahead and move on to the question and answer portion of the call. We'll open the floor to your questions. And for those of you who haven't joined us on the calls before, in a moment you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. That's star and the pound key.
Christian.
Yes.
This is Edwin. Can I just put in a couple of comments on Peter's reactions to Peter's comments?
Absolutely. Let me just turn on the full request mode, and so while you're giving your comments, our callers can go ahead and dial on and get in line.
Yeah. Okay.
Go ahead, Mr. Williamson.
Okay. Peter, I would on the this interpretation and the evolution of the language, I do think it's important to note that the you know, for most of the negotiating life of the ICCPR, initially they had the language, and essentially that is now the ensure language to all individuals within, subject to its jurisdiction. And then Mrs. Roosevelt said, no, that'll put us in a difficult situation trying to ensure rights to people subject to our jurisdiction who are in the territory of other countries. And it was for that reason that the language individuals within its territory was inserted. And then it was only much later that that the words respect were inserted. And it's really the thing that's sort of strange about it is that they clearly did not work it through very well, and respect just doesn't work grammatically unless you do the formulation that I indicated, and which no one has proposed to date. So I think basically the parties have been living with the structure as it exists, and has boiled down to the U.S. position. And in fact, you referred to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which sort of did it both ways. So in one place they paraphrased it the way you suggested, but in another place they summarized it as saying that each party to the covenant undertakes, quote, to respect and to ensure, close quotes, to all individuals within its territory, blah, 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 and under its jurisdiction. So I, at the end of the day, I think just from a grammatical standpoint, I would say that waking up in the morning and deciding that and means or is a bigger change than trying to make sense out of the sort of mess that's there. So anyway, I'll...
Thanks, Edwin.
Fantastic. Any other reactions from the panel to that?
I'll let it go to questions from the audience.
Okay. Well, we don't, again, for our audience, if you'd like to ask a question of any of our speakers individually or pose anything to the panel, press star and then the pound key. Again, that's star and the pound key. One quick programming note, our next scheduled telephone conference call will be Thursday, March 20th at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, which will be a discussion on whether the Hate Crimes Prevention Act is in part unconstitutional, sponsored by the Civil Rights Practice Group, featuring Professor Jennifer McHoward from Notre Dame Law School and Professor Gail Harriet from San Diego Law School. Well, it looks like we've got a relatively shy audience this afternoon who seems to be holding back their questions. I wanted to go to Professor Margulies. Did you have anything to add to the last discussion in reaction to the opening statements?
Let me add just a couple of points on for one thing on the sort of the vintage of the U.S. position here, right? Which is the first time the U.S. categorically said that the ICCPR applies conjunctively. That is, you have to have folks who are both within your jurisdiction and your territory. Was in 1994. As Edwin mentioned yesterday in our conference call on this, and that was when Conrad Harper, who was then the legal advisor to the State Department, articulated that view. But that view was certainly in question in 2010 when the U.S. submitted its fourth periodic report to the Human Rights Committee of the United Nations, as charged with reviewing reports by states' parties to the ICCPR. At that point, the U.S. acknowledged that it was mindful of considerations that went the other way, that is, that accorded with the rest of the world's interpretation of the treaty. So that looks like you're considering a period from 1994 to 2010. That's 16 years, which is not insignificant, but hardly the kind of long-held version of a U.S. position that we'd want to defer to in some absolute sense. And as Edwin said, the language itself of the treaty is kind of a mess. Right? And so if it is kind of a mess, as we all seem to agree, then maybe the best course of action is to take very seriously the reading that's proposed by the rest of the world.
May I interject something?
Absolutely.
Let's assume for a moment that the treaty was intended to apply extraterritorially. What exactly does that mean in practical terms?
Well, I'd say that it means that, and this is consistent with what the European Court of Human Rights has said, is that you need control, you need at least effective control of a territory or of a person, or maybe of some kind of modality like communications. So if you're an occupying power, then I think, as Eleanor Roosevelt conceded, your own occupying troops have to respect the rights that are contained in the treaty. That is, they have to behave in accordance with the treaty's terms. They can't detain people arbitrarily, detain civilians. They can't repress expression without some clear warrant in national security. They have to respect the terms. Similarly,
if you're an occupying power and you point to the Fourth Geneva Convention as conferring rights and duties, and those are narrower than the ICCPR.
I think generally there, and that's a wonderful question, then Edwin is correct that the law of armed conflict, otherwise known as international humanitarian law, would provide what we call the lex specialis. That is the more specific law that we should defer to. So whatever detention criteria that we think are appropriate under the law of armed conflict should basically also satisfy the ICCPR. It's really equivalent to a choice of law question. So on detention or on targeting, I think the law of armed conflict would prevail in those situations.
Excellent discussion. We do actually have our first question on the line, so let's see if we can go to our first caller.
Good afternoon. My name is Larry White. I'm calling from Turkey, I'm a retired Air Force officer, second career lawyer. And Professor Margulis, if this sounds familiar to you, I'm a 2004 graduate of Roger Williams and had the privilege of taking classes from you twice.
Larry, hi. How are you doing?
Hi. Good. I'm also an advisor to the NATO Counterterrorism Center here in Ankara. My question revolves around the fact of just how much of a difference this is, because when we look about specifically with military forces and whether or not we have to apply the ICCPR, we still don't have to worry about Common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention, which in many ways covers the same rights, do we not?
Well, I'd agree. So, for example, in 2006, John Bellinger, who at that point was legal advisor to the State Department, said, regardless of the interpretation we apply to the ICCPR, we are bound by the law of armed conflict, including the Geneva Conventions and Common Article 3, which bars torture, also bars cruel and humiliating treatment. So those are requirements in any case. Where the difference comes in is on the question of non-refoulement under the CAT. So that's a particular question there. Do we have to be wary of returning people to countries that practice torture? Right? If they are detainees that we have acquired in an armed conflict. That's sort of where the rubber meets the road. For instance, the U.S. says with respect to Guantanamo detainees that although as a matter of policy, we don't return people to countries that practice torture. So, for example, that's why we did not return the Uyghurs, the so-called Uyghurs who are ethnic Turks, but Chinese nationals, never returned them to China. But the U.S. has always said that is only a matter of policy. It's just discretion on our part. It's not a legal requirement. I think that's wrong. I think as a matter of law, we are obligated under the CAT not to send people back to a place where they might be tortured. But the point here is that's in no way a difference from current U.S. policy, where we still do that even though we say it's just a matter of discretion.
Of course, the irony of all that is that torture is somehow more heinous than sending them to China, where they might be simply taken out and shot, or given a Trump trial and taken out and shot. That's all right. They weren't tortured, so it's okay. There are a lot of perversities in all of this.
This is Edmund again. Let me just sort of three quick points from comments that Peter's made. Peter, first, this comment on the vintage of the U.S. Position. Conrad, my immediate successor, took this position in 1994, but the U.S. did not ratify the ICCPR until 1992. So I would argue that in 20 of the 22, this has been the U.S., clear U.S. position for 20 of the 22 years that it's been a state party. One little digression before I go to the other two points is that Nick and I are probably the ones who should have red faces here, because as we indicated, we were both, the ICCPR was set back up to the Senate when we were serving in the first Bush administration, and I've got to admit for the life of me, this issue did not come up at all. And although I may not even been all that alert if it had come up as an extraterritorial question, I do think that if somebody had said, of course, we're going to interpret the word and as or, I think a flag might have gone up. On to the question that our caller just asked that goes into my category of sort of what difference does it make. Peter, give us some examples outside of the conflict area where you would apply the ICCPR extraterritorially, where the U.S. is, where you wouldn't apply it under the current U.S. position.
Edmund, well, let me give Peter a little more time to think about that.
Okay.
This is Nick Rostow, by chiming in on the context in which the ICCPR came up. As I recall, it came up at the same time as the Convention on the Rights of Women and the Rights of the Child, and those conventions posed much more complicated problems for the United States because of our federal system and the allocation of responsibility with respect to children and women and men, too, for that matter, to the states as opposed to the federal, more limited role of the federal government. And I remember the ICCPR reading very much like our Bill of Rights, as it was intended to do, and seemed as American as apple pie and therefore not really a problem and didn't take much attention. So you're quite right, I'm blushing.
Before Peter also, I'm sure you don't need the time, but anyway, let me just, my sort of third point was that on this definition, the Article 3 under the CAT, on the 2 points on the expel, return, or extradite. First, I think all three of those words assume a person is in one's territory, and I think that must be the reason that it does, that Article 3 doesn't have a geographical element in it. The second thing is that, and I actually think this is probably a little surprising, but my interpretation also means that it doesn't pick up, just a flat-out transfer. And I would question whether or not the drafters really intended that. But having said that, I think one has to live with the fact that return is not synonymous with transfer. I mean, return, or particularly refoulement, has a geographical element of it. For those who are interested in this minutiae, there is a, in the CAT memo, Harold does cite a letter I wrote when I was a legal advisor in interpreting the refoulement. And it was interesting that there was a failed attempt at a covenant on the territorial asylum, and it fell apart because the parties couldn't agree on the language, and the proposal was not only to include return or refoulement, but also I can't remember the phrase now, but it was to prevent the coming into one's country. I guess it was the and that were clearly, so there was a felt to be a need to include a word that addressed a situation where the victim had not, the subject had not reached the shores of the state party. Sorry.
This is Peter Margulies. Let me try to first answer the question that, I guess, Edwin and Nick both posed, which is what difference does this make? And again, as I said, in the context of surveillance, I'd argue that the relevant test there is we have what amounts to virtual control over electronic digital media worldwide. So we can eavesdrop on conversations. We also have the technology, apparently, according to news reports, to in some ways change information that people get. In the Stuxnet or Olympic Games episode, which has been widely reported, involved U.S. participation, we alter data that operators of centrifuges in Iran receive. And because they received the wrong data, they allowed those centrifuges to basically run until they burned up. So we have vast control over electronic communications. And I think that's certainly the equivalent of the kind of effective control that the European courts have looked at as a test for control over persons or over territory. And so that means I think you do get to the substantive portion of the ICCPR. But again, the good news there for the U.S. is that Article 17 of the ICCPR only bars arbitrary intrusions on privacy. We can meet that test. And to me, it's far more effective for us to fight on that ground rather than fight about the territorial application of the treaty. Let me also say one or two quick things about the question of non-refoulement. I do think that the question of extraterritoriality is a treaty-specific question. And as to the Convention on Refugees, I'd agree with the U.S. Supreme Court in the Haitian Centers Council versus Sale case, which said that that treaty doesn't contemplate extraterritorial application, that there the term return has an inevitable territorial implication. And the term refoulement has even clearer implication to that effect. Furthermore, if you look at the travaux préparatoires, the legislative history of the Convention on Refugees, you have declarations from the Netherlands and from Switzerland, which say clearly they didn't anticipate that the treaty would bind them to accept people in, as opposed to intercepting refugees, for example, on the high seas, which is what we did in the Haitian Centers Council case. And that declaration by the Netherlands was not subject to any objection from the rest of the state's parties that were present. So that treaty, I think, makes it clear that you don't have extraterritorial application. But if you look at the ICCPR, I think that's a very different story.
And this is Christian Corrigan. Any other reactions, Dr. Rostow or Mr. Williamson?
No, I think it's always a good idea to behave like a gentleman or gentlewoman.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to ask the question and for doing this for us.
Happy to do it.
Excellent. Well, we've got about 10 minutes left, but I don't see any other questions on the line. So I just want to give, if any of the panelists have any other questions they'd like to ask or pose to the group, we could do that now, or we can go ahead and move on to sort of closing statements. Give everybody a couple minutes to sum up their thoughts and put a bow around this around the call. Any other questions?
I'll just mention something. This is Peter Margulies again. I'll mention something about the Convention Against Torture. And Edwin's point there. The language in the Convention Against Torture speaks to territory under jurisdiction. So that language, again, the language of every treaty is different, as we know, that language seems to merge the concepts of territory and jurisdiction, and it seems to contemplate rights that would accrue in territory that is under a country's effective control, including in a situation like occupation. And again, I think that stands to reason that if our troops go somewhere, they should have the same duties that they'd have in the U.S. And of course, those troops, as everyone acknowledges, have duties under the Geneva Conventions, which would largely track duties under the Convention Against Torture. So really, in some sense, this reading actually promotes uniformity, which is always a good thing in international law. You don't want to be subject to disparate obligations, as I'm sure Edwin and Nick would agree. And so here we have a uniform application. The only difference is on non-refoulement, where we reserve the right to deport people, the places that practice torture. But again, in practice, we haven't done so. We've always said we're going to hold on to people until we know we can transfer them to places where they won't be tortured. That's why the Uyghurs didn't go back to China. Instead, we waited till we could place them in other countries, including the former Solomon Islands and Albania and most recently Slovakia, because those are places where we felt people wouldn't be tortured.
Let me just, this is Nick Rostow again, let me just add a footnote to Peter's last point. I mean, the U.S. attitude on non-refoulement was very heavily influenced by the spectacle of Soviet prisoners of war held by the Western Allies who committed suicide rather than be sent home to the Soviet Union.
This is Peter Margulies again. I think that's right, although I would say, and I'd be interested to see what Nick and Edwin have to say about this, that in a situation of international armed conflict, such as the contest between U.S. and Germany, say, or U.S. Involvement in Korea, that it's not clear to me that the non-refoulement obligations of the CAT apply there. So suppose you have 200,000 Chinese POWs, as we have pretty much in Korea. I'm not clear that you're obliged to have an individualized determination as to whether any of those folks or each of them will be subject to torture. I think that would be an unmanageable obligation of the kind that Eleanor Roosevelt said in the debates on the ICCPR, we would not be prepared to undertake. So there, I think the usual law of international armed conflict ought to apply with respect to return of POWs. But in a non-international armed conflict, like the one we're engaged in with Al-Qaeda, where you're talking about far smaller groups of people, there I think it is manageable to undertake an individualized inquiry. We, in fact, have done that, and I think we ought to understand ourselves to be legally bound to do it.
I should know this, but isn't there the equivalent of a non-refoulement obligation under the Geneva Conventions? That,
I'm not sure that obligation is expressed, although it might be understood in certain circumstances.
Yeah.
I also should know, and I don't, but I don't know that, you know, practicality is. Is the kind of principled legal position that I'm that comfortable with. I mean, I understand from a practical point of view that's reality, but I'm not sure it's a principled argument.
And Peter, on the territory under its jurisdiction, I mean, I think the U.S. position is that it's territory under its jurisdiction as a governmental authority, so that would pick up the occupied and it picks up Guantanamo, for example, and the so I don't this isn't a you know there's no doubt about that. At one point during the W administration, there was an attempt to narrow quite considerably the territorial application by bootstrapping on the definition of torture, which is tied into, you know, as under you know, the U.S. what the U.S. Constitution, Articles, I guess, what, 5, 8, and 14. And they said, well, since those would only apply in respect of something that was in the territory of the U.S., then it that must be the geographical. That, I think that position was, and has been as referred to in Harold's memo, was pretty much pretty quickly dismissed within the Bush administration and never really got anywhere.
Well, this is Peter Margulies. I agree. I think that certainly after the Hamdan case in 2006, where the Supreme Court said that the Uniform Code of Military Justice basically adopted the Geneva Conventions and the conflict with al-Qaeda had to be considered a non-international armed conflict that was subject to the protections of Common Article 3 of Geneva, that the former position that Edwin has described had basically went by the boards. So as of then, I think it's certainly clear that where we had custody over individuals pretty much anywhere around the world, that we're certainly bound by Common Article 3. And, of course, the Supreme Court said in the Boumediene case in 2008 that habeas corpus was available to detainees at least at Guantanamo, where we had effective control, as Edwin said, although the federal courts have for a long time said that habeas corpus isn't available to people held anywhere else around the world. So, for example, it's not available to people at the former Bagram base in Afghanistan, where there is more question about whether we actually exercise that kind of effective control.
Let me say a word about the Hamdan case since you brought it up. I mean, I think there's a tremendous intellectual incoherence on the one hand and humanity on the other in that decision. The incoherence is the notion that one can be in a global non-international armed conflict, which on its face doesn't make any sense. But the court, in my view, clearly did not want to say these people occupy a legal no man's land where no law governs. And so by saying, well, these are people who are engaged in a non-international armed conflict, however, not located in a single country, and therefore have rights under Common Article 3, they're saying there is no such thing in this case as a legal no man's land. I think that's a sound outcome, although the reasoning is a little strange.
Yeah.
This is Peter Margulies. I would certainly agree with Nick's view that there are doctrinal difficulties with viewing the conflict with al-Qaeda as a non-international armed conflict. Traditionally, that category has been reserved for internal rebellions. Clearly, that isn't true of the conflict with al-Qaeda. But I also strongly agree with Nick that I think the court was really trying to get at the notion that had been expressed at one point in the prior administration that we could treat detainees without observing the Geneva Conventions at all. And the court was saying, no, you got to observe the conventions. They're basically a floor that all civilized nations subscribe to. And I think on that ground, the decision is definitely defensible. I would note, though, that in the second term of the Bush administration, folks like Condi Rice and John Bellinger, the then legal advisor of the State Department, said the same thing, that we were bound by the laws of war, including the obligation to comply with Common Article 3. And so those folks pushed back internally to get the administration to treat detainees in a way that was consistent with international law.
Excellent. Well, this is Christian Corrigan, and we're running now right at the end of our time. So I want to wrap up this call by thanking all three of our speakers, Mr. Williamson, Professor Margulies, and Dr. Rostow for taking the time to be with us this afternoon on this very interesting call. And I think we had a great discussion between all of the panelists. So I want to express Federal Society's appreciation for everyone's participation, as well as our audience. I want to thank as well. Join us Thursday at 3 p.m. for our next scheduled teleforum conference call. And we always welcome your feedback on our website, or by email to info@fedsoc.org. And until the next time, we are adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.